She came back at the end of 2 weeks with the following in the way of on dictaphone belts. We are now at the year 1908, which was the year that the Carnegie began operations. And in that year, the trustees, meeting for the first time, raise a specific question, which they discuss throughout the balance of the year in a very learned fashion. And the question is there any means known more effective than war, assuming you wish to alter the life of an entire people? And they conclude that no more effective means than war to that end is known to humanity. So then in 1909 they raise the second question and discuss it, namely, how do we involve the United States in a war? Then finally they answer that question as follows: we must control the State Department. And they and then that very naturally raises the question of how do we do that? And they answer it by saying, we must take over and control the diplomatic machinery of this country. And finally they resolve to aim at that as an objective. Then time passes and we are eventually in a war, which would have been World War I. And at that time they record on their minutes a shocking report in which they dispatched to President Wilson a telegram cautioning him to see that the war does not end too quickly. And finally, of course, we are the war is over. At that time, their interest shifts over to preventing what they call a reversion of life in the United States to what it was prior to 1914. At that point, they come to the conclusion that to prevent a reversion, we must control education in the United States. Yeah, I might tell you this experience, as far as its impact on Catherine Casey was concerned, was she never was able to return to her law practice. If it hadn't been for Carol Reese's ability to tuck her away in a job with the Federal Trade Commission, I don't know what would have happened to Catherine. But ultimately, she lost her mind as a result of it.
And the organization investigating the efficacy of war, which is referred to as the Carnegie Endowment, the full name is the Carnegie Endowment for World Peace. And its president from 1910 to 1925 was Elihu Root. And that's about the halfway mark in this film on banking cartels and the Federal Reserve. We shall catch up with part two next week, I dare say. Now let's conclude with David Graeber. We're going to pick up where we left off last week, that idea about granting independence to the logic of money.
Under the newly emerging capitalist order, the logic of money was granted autonomy. Political and military power were then gradually reorganized around it. True, this was a financial logic that could never have existed without states and armies behind it in the first place. As we have seen in the case of medieval Islam, under genuine free market conditions, in which the state is not involved in regulating the market in any significant way, even in enforcing commercial contracts, purely competitive markets will not develop, and loans at interest will become effectively impossible to collect. It was only the Islamic prohibition against usury, really, that made it possible for them to create an economic system that stood so far apart from the state. Martin Luther was making this very point in 1524, right around the time that Cortes was first beginning to have trouble with his creditors. It's all very well, Luther said, for us to imagine that all might live as true Christians, in accordance with the dictates of the gospel. But, in fact, there are few who are really capable of acting this way. Quote, Christians are rare in this world. Therefore the world needs a strict, hard, temporal government that will compel and constrain the wicked not to rob and to return what they borrow, even though a Christian ought not to demand it, or even to hope to get it back. This is necessary in order that the world not become a desert, peace may not perish, and trade and society not be utterly destroyed, all of which would happen if we were to rule the world according to the gospel and not drive and compel the wicked by laws and the use of force to do what is right. Let no one think that the world can be ruled without blood, for the sword of the ruler must be red and bloody, for the world will and must be evil, and the sword is God's rod and vengeance upon it. Unquote. Not to rob and to return what they borrow. A telling juxtaposition, considering that in scholastic theory, lending money at interest had itself been considered theft, and Luther was referring to interest-bearing loans here. The story of how he got to this point is telling. Luther began his career as a reformer in 1520, with fiery campaigns against usury. In fact, one of his objections to the sale of church indulgences was that it was itself a form of spiritual usury. These positions won him enormous popular support in towns and villages. However, he soon realized that he'd unleashed a genie that threatened to turn the whole world upside down. More radical reformers appeared, arguing that the poor were not morally obliged to repay the interest on usurious loans, and proposing the revival of Old Testament institutions like the sabbatical year. They were followed by outright revolutionary preachers who began once again questioning the very legitimacy of aristocratic privilege and private property. In 1525, the year after Luther's sermon, there was a massive uprising of peasants, miners, and poor townsfolk across Germany, the rebels in most cases representing themselves as simple Christians, aiming to restore the true communism of the Gospels. Over 100,000 were slaughtered. Already in 1524, Luther had a sense that matters were spilling out of control, and that he would have to choose sides. In that text, he did so. Old Testament laws like the sabbatical year, he argued, are no longer binding. The gospel merely describes ideal behavior, gave us the divine law, to love thy neighbour as thyself. If we truly kept this law, humans would exist freely to one another, and private property would not exist. However, Jesus accepted, no human being has ever been able to live up to this pure communistic standard. Therefore, God has also given us a second, inferior, human law, to be enforced by the civil authorities. While this inferior law cannot compel us to act as we really ought to act, the magistrate can force no one to lend out what belongs to him without hope of recompense or profit. At least it can make us follow the lead of the Apostle Paul, who said, "Pay all men what you owe." Soon afterward, Calvin was to reject the blanket ban on usury entirely, and by 1650 almost all Protestant denominations had come to agree with his position that a reasonable rate of interest, usually 5%, was not sinful, provided the lender act in good conscience, do not make lending their exclusive business, and do not exploit the poor. Catholic doctrine was slower to come around, but it ultimately did accede by passive acquiescence. If one looks at how all this was justified, two things jump out. First, Protestant thinkers all continued to make the old medieval argument about interest, that interest is really compensation for the money that the lender would have made had he been able to place his money in some more profitable investment. Originally, this logic was just applied to commercial loans. Increasingly, it was now applied to all loans. Far from being unnatural, then, the growth of money was now treated as completely expected. All money was assumed to be capital. Second, the assumption that usury is something that one properly practices on one's enemies, and therefore by extension, that all commerce partakes something of the nature of war, never entirely disappears. Calvin, for instance, denied that Deuteronomy only referred to the Amalekites. Clearly, he said, it meant that usury was acceptable when dealing with Syrians or Egyptians, indeed with all nations with whom the Jews traded. The result of opening the gates was, at least tacitly, to suggest that one could now treat anyone, even a neighbour, as a foreigner. One need only observe how European merchant adventurers of the day actually were treating foreigners in Asia, Africa, and the Americas to understand what this might mean in practice. Or one might look closer to home. Take the story of another well-known debtor of the time, the Margrave Casimir of Brandenburg-Ansbach, 1481 to 1527, or of the famous Hohenzollern dynasty. Casimir was the son of Margrave Friedrich the Elder of Brandenburg, who has come to be known as one of the mad princes of the German Renaissance. Sources differ on just how mad he actually was. One contemporary chronicle describes him as somewhat deranged in his head from too much racing and jousting. Most agree that he was given to fits of inexplicable rage, as well as to the sponsorship of wild, extravagant festivals, said often to have degenerated into wild bacchanalian orgies. All agree, however, that he was poor at managing his money. At the beginning of 1515, Friedrich was in such financial trouble, he said to have owed 200,000 guilders, that he alerted his creditors, mostly fellow nobles, that he might soon be forced to temporarily suspend interest payments on his debts. This seems to have caused a crisis of faith, and within a matter of weeks, his son Casimir staged a palace coup, moving in the early hours of February 26, 1515, to seize control of the castle of Plassenburg, while his father was distracted with a celebration of carnival, then forcing him to sign papers abdicating for reason of mental infirmity. Friedrich spent the rest of his life confined to Plassenburg, denied all visitors and correspondents. When, at one point, his guards requested that the new Margrave provide a couple guilders so he could pass the time gambling with them, Casimir made a great public show of refusal, stating, ridiculously of course, that his father had left affairs in such disastrous shape that he could not possibly afford to. Casimir dutifully doled out governorships and other prize offices to his father's creditors. He tried to get his house in order, but this proved surprisingly difficult. His enthusiastic embrace of Luther's reforms in 1521 clearly had as much to do with the prospect of getting his hands on church lands and monastic assets than with any particular religious fervour. Yet, at first, the disposition of church property remained moot, and Casimir himself compounded his problems by running up gambling debts of his own, said to have amounted to nearly 50,000 guilders. Placing his creditors in charge of the civil administration had predictable effects. Increasing exactions on his subjects, many of whom became hopelessly indebted themselves. Unsurprisingly, Casimir's lands in the Tauber Valley in Franconia became one of the epicenters of the revolt in 1525. Bands of armed villagers assembled, declaring that they would obey no law that did not accord with the holy word of God. At first, the nobles, isolated in their scattered castles, offered little resistance. The rebel leaders, many of them local shopkeepers, butchers, and other prominent men from nearby towns, began with a largely orderly campaign of tearing down castle fortifications, their knightly occupants being offered guarantees of safety if they cooperated, agreed to abandon their feudal privileges, and swore oaths to abide by the rebels' 12 articles. Many complied. The real venom of the rebels was reserved for cathedrals and monasteries, dozens of which were sacked, pillaged, and destroyed. Casimir's reaction was to hedge his bets. At first he bided his time, assembling an armed force of about 2,000 experienced soldiers, but refusing to intervene as rebels pillaged several nearby monasteries. In fact, negotiating with the various rebel bands, in such apparent good faith that many believed he was preparing to join them as a Christian brother. In May, however, after the Knights of the Swabian League defeated the rebels of the Christian Union to the south, Casimir swung into action, his forces brushing aside poorly disciplined rebel bands to sweep through his own territories like a conquering army, burning and pillaging villages and towns, slaughtering women and children. In every town he set up punitive tribunals, and seized all looted property, which he kept, even as his men also expropriated any wealth still to be found in the region's cathedrals, ostensibly as emergency loans to pay his troops. It seems significant that Casimir was, of all the German princes, both the longest to waver before intervening, and the most savagely vengeful once he did. His forces became notorious, not only for executing accused rebels, but systematically chopping off the fingers of accused collaborators. His executioner, keeping a grim ledger of amputated body parts for later reimbursement, a kind of carnal inversion of the account ledgers that had caused him so much trouble in his life. At one point, in the town of Kitzingen, Casimir ordered the gouging out of the eyes of 58 burghers who had, he declared, refused to look at him as their lord. Afterward, he received the following bill. 80 beheaded. 69 eyes put out or fingers cut off. 114.5 guilders. From Mr. de Tucht, received from the Rotenburgers, 10 guilders, received from Ludwig von Hutten, 2 guilders, remainder, plus 2 months' pay at 8 guilders per month, 16 guilders, total 118.5 guilders, signed, Augustine the Executioner, who the Kitzingers call Master Ouch. The repression eventually inspired Casimir's brother Georg, later known as the Pious, to write a letter asking him if Casimir was intending to take up a trade, since, as Georg gently reminded him, he could not very well continue to be a feudal overlord if his peasants were all dead. With such things happening, it is hardly surprising that men like Thomas Hobbes came to imagine the basic nature of society as a war of all against all, from which only the absolute power of monarchs could save us. At the same time, Casimir's behaviour, combining as it does a general attitude of unprincipled, cold-blooded calculation with outbursts of almost inexplicably vindictive cruelty, seems, like that of Cortes's angry foot soldiers when unleashed on the Aztec provinces, to embody something essential about the psychology of debt, or, more precisely perhaps, about the debtor who feels he has done nothing to deserve being placed in his position, the frantic urgency of having to convert everything around oneself into money, and rage and indignation at having been reduced to the sort of person who would do so. Part 2. The World of Credit and the World of Interest.
It begins with some words from Charles Davenant in 1696. Quote, "Of all the beings that have existence only in the minds of men, nothing is more fantastical and nice than credit. It is never to be forced. It hangs upon opinion. It depends upon our passions of hope and fear. It comes many times unsought for, and often goes away without reason. And once lost, it is hardly to be quite recovered." Unquote. And an English and German proverb, "He that has lost his credit is dead to the world." The peasants' visions of communistic brotherhood didn't come out of nowhere. They were rooted in real daily experience, of the maintenance of common fields and forests, of everyday cooperation and neighbourly solidarity. It is out of such homely experience of everyday communism that grand mythic visions are always built. Obviously, rural communities were also divided squabbling places, since communities always are. But, insofar as they are communities at all, they are necessarily founded on a ground of mutual aid. The same, incidentally, can be said of the members of the aristocracy, who might have fought endlessly over love, land, honour and religion, but nonetheless still cooperated remarkably well with one another when it really mattered, most of all when their position as aristocrats was threatened. Just as the merchants and bankers, much as they competed with one another, managed to close ranks when it really mattered. This is what I refer to as the communism of the rich, and it is a powerful force in human history. The same, as we've seen repeatedly, applies to credit. There are always different standards for those one considers friends or neighbours. The inexorable nature of interest-bearing debt, and the alternately savage and calculating behaviour of those enslaved to it, are typical, above all, of dealings between strangers. It's unlikely that Casimir felt much more kinship with his peasants than Cortes did with the Aztecs. In fact, most likely less, since Aztec warriors were at least aristocrats. Inside the small towns and rural hamlets, where the state was mostly far away, medieval standards survived intact, and credit was just as much a matter of honour and reputation as it had ever been. The great untold story of our current age is of how these ancient credit systems were ultimately destroyed, Recent historical research, notably that of Craig Mulgrew, who sifted through thousands of inventories and court cases from the 16th and 17th century England, has caused us to revise almost all our old assumptions about what everyday economic life at that time was like. Of course, very little of the American gold and silver that reached Europe actually ended up in the pockets of ordinary farmers, mercers, or haberdashers. The lion's share stayed in the coffers of either the aristocracy or the great London merchants, or else in the royal treasury. Small change was almost non-existent. As I've already pointed out, in the poorer neighbourhoods of cities or large towns, shopkeepers would issue their own lead, leather, or wooden token money. And in the 16th century, this became something of a fad, with artisans and even poor widows producing their own currency as a way to make ends meet. Elsewhere, those frequenting the local butcher, baker, or shoemaker would simply put things on a tab. The same was true of those attending weekly markets, or selling neighbours milk, or cheese, or candle wax.
In a typical village, the only people likely to pay cash were passing travellers, and those considered riff-raff, paupers, and ne'er-do-wells so notoriously down on their luck that no one would extend credit to them. Since everyone was involved in selling something, however, just about everyone was both creditor and debtor. Most family income took the form of promises from other families. Everyone knew and kept count of what their neighbours owed one another. And every 6 months or a year or so, communities would hold a general public reckoning, cancelling out debts against each other in a great circle, with only those differences then remaining, when all was done, being settled by use of coin or goods. The reason that this upends our assumptions is that we're used to blaming the rise of capitalism on something vaguely called the market, the breakup of older systems of mutual aid and solidarity, and the creation of a world of cold calculation where everything had its price. Really, English villagers appear to have seen no contradiction between the two. On the one hand, they believed strongly in the collective stewardship of fields, streams, and forests, and the need to help neighbours in difficulty. On the other hand, markets were seen as a kind of attenuated version of the same principle, since they were entirely founded on trust. Much like the Tiv women with their gifts of yams and okra, neighbours assumed they ought to be constantly slightly in debt to one another. At the same time, most seemed to have been quite comfortable with the idea of buying and selling, or even with market fluctuations, provided it didn't get to the point of threatening honest families' livelihoods. Even when loans at interest began to be legalized in 1545, that didn't ruffle too many feathers, as long as it took place within that same larger moral framework. Lending was considered an appropriate vocation, for example, with widows with no other source of income, or as a way for neighbours to share in the profits from some minor commercial venture. William Stout, a Quaker merchant from Lancashire, spoke glowingly of Henry Coward, the tradesman in whose shop he first apprenticed. Quote, "My master then had a full trade of groceries, ironmonger ware, and several other goods, and very much respected and trusted, not only by the people of his own religious profession, but by all others of all professions and circumstances. His credit was so much that any who had money to dispose of lodged it with him, to put out at interest, or to make use of it." Unquote. In this world, trust was everything. Most money literally was trust, since most credit arrangements were handshake deals. When people used the word credit, they referred, above all, to a reputation for honesty and integrity, and a man or woman's honour, virtue, and respectability, but also reputation for generosity, decency, and good-natured sociability, were at least as important considerations when deciding whether to make a loan as were assessments of net income. As a result, financial terms became indistinguishable from moral ones. One could speak of others as worthies, as a woman of high estimation, or a man of no account, and equally of giving credit to someone's words when one believes what they say. Credit is from the same root as creed or credibility, or of extending credit to them, when one takes them at their word that they'll pay one back. One shouldn't idealize the situation. This was a highly patriarchal world. A man's wife or daughter's reputation for chastity was as much a part of his credit as his own reputation for kindness or piety. What's more, almost all people below the age of 30, male or female, were employed as servants in someone else's household, as farmhands, milkmaids, apprentices, and as such were of no account at all. Finally, those who lost credibility in the eyes of the community became effectively pariahs, and descended into the criminal or semi-criminal classes of rootless labourers, beggars, harlots, cut-purses, hawkers, peddlers, fortune-tellers, minstrels, and other such masterless men or women of ill repute. Cold cash was employed largely between strangers, or when paying rents, tithes, and taxes to landlords, bailiffs, priests, and other superiors. The landed gentry and wealthy merchants, who eschewed handshake deals, would often use cash with one another, especially to pay off bills of exchange drawn on London markets. Above all, gold and silver were used by the government to purchase arms and pay soldiers, and among the criminal classes themselves. This meant that coins were most likely to be used both by the sort of people who ran the legal system, the magistrates, constables, and justices of the peace, and by those violent elements of society they saw it as their business to control. Over time, this led to an increasing disjuncture of moral universes. For most, who tried to avoid entanglement in the legal system, just as much as they tried to avoid the affairs of soldiers and criminals, debt remained the very fabric of sociability. But those who spent their working lives within the halls of government and great commercial houses gradually began to develop a very different perspective, whereby cash exchange was normal, and it was debt that came to be seen as tinged with criminality. Each perspective turned on a certain tacit theory of the nature of society. For most English villagers, the real font and focus of social and moral life was not so much the church as the local alehouse, and community was embodied above all in the conviviality of popular festivals, like Christmas or May Day, with everything that such celebrations entailed, the sharing of pleasures, the communion of the senses, all the physical embodiment of what was called good neighbourhood. Society was rooted above all in the love and amity of friends and kin, and it found expression in all these forms of everyday communism, helping neighbours with chores, providing milk or cheese for old widows, that were seen to flow from it. Markets were not seen as contradicting this ethos of mutual aid. It was, much as it was for Tushy, an extension of mutual aid, and for much the same reason, because it operated entirely through trust and credit. England might not have produced a great theorist like Tushy, but one can find the same assumptions echoed in most of the scholastic writers, as, for instance, in Jean Bonnat's De Republica, widely circulated in English translation after 1605. Amity and friendship, Bonnat wrote, are the foundation of all human and civil society. They constitute that true natural justice on which the whole legal structure of contracts, courts, and even government must necessarily be built. Similarly, when economic thinkers reflected on the origins of money, they spoke of trusting, exchanging, and trading. It was simply assumed that human relations came first. As a result, all motions came to be conceived as debts. Forgive us our debts. This was the period, the very end of the Middle Ages, that this translation of the Lord's Prayer gained such universal popularity. Sins are debts to God, unavoidable but perhaps manageable, since at the end of time our moral debts and credits will be cancelled out against each other in God's final reckoning. The notion of debt inserted itself into even the most intimate of human relations. Like the Tiv, medieval villagers would sometimes refer to flesh debts, but the notion was completely different. It referred to the right of either partner in a marriage to demand sex from the other, which, in principle, either could do whenever he or she desired. The phrase paying one's debts thus developed connotations, much as the Roman phrase doing one's duty had centuries before. Geoffrey Chaucer even makes a pun out of tally, French taille, and tail, in The Shipman's Tale, a story about a woman who pays her husband's debts with sexual favours. "And if I be so fail, I am your wife, score it upon my tail." even London merchants would occasionally appeal to the language of sociability, insisting that, in the final analysis, all trade is built on credit, and credit is really just an extension of mutual aid. In 1696, for instance, Charles Davenant wrote that even if there were a general collapse of confidence in the credit system, it could not last long, because eventually, when people reflected on the matter and realized that credit is simply an extension of human society, quote, they will find that no trading nation ever did subsist and carry on its business by real stock, that is, just coin and merchandise, that trust and confidence in each other are as necessary to link and hold a people together as obedience, love, friendship, or the intercourse of speech. And when experience has taught man how weak he is, depending only on himself, he will be willing to help others, and call upon the assistance of his neighbours, which, of course, by degrees, must set credit again afloat. Unquote. Davenant was an unusual merchant. His father was a poet. More typical of his class were men like Thomas Hobbes, whose Leviathan, published in 1651, was in many ways an extended attack on the very idea that society is built on any sort of prior ties of communal solidarity. Hobbes might be considered the opening salvo of a new moral perspective, and it was a devastating one. When Leviathan came out, it's not clear what scandalized its readers more. Its relentless materialism — Hobbes insisted that humans were basically machines whose actions could be understood by one single principle, that they tended to move toward the prospect of pleasure and away from the prospect of pain — or its resultant cynicism. If love, amity, and trust are such powerful forces, Hobbes asked, why is it that even within our families we lock our most valuable possessions in strongboxes? Still, Hobbes's ultimate argument, that humans, being driven by self-interest, can't be trusted to treat each other justly of their own accord, and therefore that society only emerges when they come to realize that it is to their long-term advantage to give up a portion of their liberties and accept the absolute power of the king, differed little from arguments that theologians like Martin Luther had been making a century earlier. Hobbes simply substituted scientific language for biblical references. I want to draw particular attention to the underlying notion of self-interest. It is, in a real sense, the key to the new philosophy. The term first appears in English right around the time of Hobbes, and it is indeed directly borrowed from interesse, the Roman law term for interest payments. When it was first introduced, most English authors seemed to view the idea that all human life can be explained as the pursuit of self-interest as a cynical, foreign, Machiavellian idea, one that sat uncomfortably with traditional English mores. By the 18th century, most in educated society accepted it as simple common sense. But why interest? Why make a general theory of human motivation out of a word that originally meant penalty for late payment on a loan? Part of the term's appeal was that it derived from bookkeeping. It was mathematical. This made it seem objective, even scientific. Saying we're all really pursuing our own self-interest provides a way to cut past the welter of passions and emotions that seem to govern our daily existence, and to motivate most of what we actually observe people to do, not only out of love and amity, but also envy, spite, devotion, pity, lust, embarrassment, torpor, indignation, pride, and discover that, despite all this, most really important decisions are based on the rational calculation of material advantage, which means that they're fairly predictable as well.
Just as the physical world is ruled by the laws of movement, wrote Helvetius in a passage reminiscent of Lord Chang, no less is the moral universe ruled by laws of interest.
And of course it was on this assumption that all the quadratic equations of economic theory could ultimately be built. The problem is that the origin of the concept is not rational at all. Its roots are theological, and the theological assumptions underpinning it never really went away. Self-interest is first attested to in the writings of the Italian historian Francesco Guicciardini, who was in fact a friend of Machiavelli. Around 1510, as a euphemism for St. Augustine's concept of self-love. For Augustine, the love of God leads us to benevolence toward our fellows. Self-love, in contrast, refers to the fact that since the fall of man, we are cursed by endless, insatiable desires for self-gratification, so much so that if left to our own devices, we will necessarily fall into universal competition, even war. Substituting interest for love must have seemed an obvious move, since the assumption that love is the primary emotion was precisely what authors like Guicciardini were trying to get away from. But it kept that same assumption of insatiable desires under the guise of impersonal math, since what is interest but the demand that money never ceased to grow? The same was true when it became the term for investments. I've a 12% interest in that venture. It's money placed in the continual pursuit of profit. The very idea that human beings are motivated primarily by self-interest, then, was rooted in the profoundly Christian assumption that we're all incorrigible sinners, left to our own devices. We will not simply choose a certain level of comfort and happiness and then stop to enjoy it. We will never cash in the chips, like Sinbad, let alone question why we need to buy chips to begin with. And, as Augustine already anticipated, infinite desires in a finite world means endless competition, which in turn is why, as Hobbes insisted, our only hope of social peace lies in contractual arrangements and strict enforcement by the apparatus of the state. The story of the origins of capitalism, then, is not the story of the gradual destruction of traditional communities by the impersonal power of the market. It's rather the story of how an economy of credit was transformed into an economy of interest, of the gradual transformation of moral networks by the intrusion of the impersonal and often vindictive power of the state. English villagers in Elizabethan or Stuart times did not like to appeal to the justice system, even when the law was in their favour, partly on the principle that neighbours should work things out with one another, but mainly because the law was so extraordinarily harsh. Under Elizabeth, for example, the punishment for vagrancy, that is, unemployment in modern terms, was, for first offence, to have one's ears nailed to a pillory, for repeat offenders, death. The same was true of debt law, especially since debt could often, if the creditor was sufficiently vindictive, be treated as a crime. In Chelsea, around 1660, quote, Margaret Sharples was prosecuted for stealing cloth, which she had converted into a petticoat for her own wearing, from Richard Bennet's shop. Her defence was that she had bargained with Richard Bennet's servant for the cloth, but, having not money sufficient in her purse to pay for it, took it away with purpose to pay for it so soon as she could, and that she afterwards agreed with Mr. Bennet of a price for it. Bennet confirmed that this was so, after agreeing to pay him 22 shillings, Margaret delivered a hamper with goods in it as a pawn for security of the money, and 4 shillings 9 pence in money. But soon after he disliked upon better consideration to hold agreement with her, and delivered the hamper and goods back, and commenced formal legal proceedings against her. Unquote. As a result, Margaret Sharples was hanged. Obviously, it was the rare shopkeeper who wished to see even his most irritating client on the gallows. Therefore, decent people tended to avoid the courts entirely. One of the most interesting discoveries of Craig Muldrew's research is that the more time passed, the less true this became. Even in the late Middle Ages, in the case of really large loans, it was not unusual for creditors to lodge claims in local courts. But this was really just a way of ensuring that there was a public record. Remember that most people at the time were illiterate. Debtors were willing to go along with the proceedings in part, it would seem, because if there was any interest being charged, it meant that if they did default, the lender was just as guilty in the eyes of the law as they were. Less than 1% of these cases were ever brought to judgment. The legalization of interest began to change the nature of the playing field. In the 1580s, when interest-bearing loans began to become common between villagers, creditors also began to insist on the use of signed legal bonds. This led to such an explosion of appeals to the courts that in many small towns, almost every household seemed to be caught up in debt litigation of some sort or another. Only a tiny proportion of these suits were ever brought to judgment either. The usual expedient was still to rely on the simple threat of punishment to encourage debtors to settle out of court. Still, as a result, the fear of the debtor's prison, or worse, came to hang over everyone, and sociability itself came to take on the colour of crime. Even Mr. Coward, the kindly shopkeeper, was eventually laid low. His good credit itself became a problem, especially as he felt honour-bound to use it to help the less fortunate. Quote,
"He also dealt in merchandise with loose partners, and became concerned much with persons of declining circumstances, where neither profit nor credit could be got, and he gave uneasiness to his wife by frequenting some houses of no good character, and she was a very indolent woman, and drew money privately from him, and his circumstances became so burdensome that he daily expected to be made a prisoner, which, with the shame of forfeiting his former reputation, it drew him into despair and broke his heart, so that he kept to his house for some time and died of grief and shame." Unquote.
It's perhaps not surprising when one consults contemporary sources about what those prisons were like, particularly for those who were not of aristocratic origins. Mr. Coward would surely have known, as the conditions at the most notorious, like Fleet and Marshalsea, caused periodic scandals when exposed in Parliament or the popular press, filling the papers with stories of shackled debtors, covered with filth and vermin, and suffered to die, without pity, of hunger and jail fever, as the aristocratic roués placed in the elite side of the same jails lived lives of comfort, visited by manicurists and prostitutes. The criminalization of debt, then, was the criminalization of the very basis of human society. It cannot be overemphasized that in a small community, everyone normally was both lender and borrower. One can only imagine the tensions and temptations that must have existed in communities, and communities, much though they are based on love, in fact, because they are based on love, will also be full of hatred, rivalry, and passion. When it became clear that with sufficiently clever scheming, manipulation, and perhaps a bit of strategic bribery, they could arrange to have almost anyone they hated imprisoned or even hanged. What was it that Richard Bennett really had against Margaret Sharples? We'll never know the back story, but it's a pretty safe bet that there was one. The effects on communal solidarity must have been devastating. The sudden accessibility of violence really did threaten to transform what had been the essence of sociality into a war of all against all. It's not surprising, then, that by the 18th century, the very notion of personal credit had acquired a bad name, with both lenders and borrowers considered equally suspect. The use of coins, at least among those who had access to them, had come to seem moral in itself. Understanding all of this allows us to see some of the European authors considered in earlier chapters in an entirely new light. Take Panurge's Encomium on Debt. It turns out that the real joke is not the suggestion that debt ties communities together. Any English or French peasant of the day would simply have assumed this, or even that only debt ties communities together. It is putting the sentiment in the mouth of a wealthy scholar who's really an inveterate criminal, that is, holding up popular morality as a mirror to make fun of the very upper classes who claim to disapprove of it. Or consider Adam Smith, quote,
"It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their advantages." Unquote.
The bizarre thing here is that at the time Smith was writing, this simply wasn't true. Most English shopkeepers were still carrying out the main part of their business on credit, which meant that customers appealed to their benevolence all the time. Smith could hardly have been unaware of this. Rather, he is drawing a utopian picture. He wants to imagine a world in which everyone used cash, in part because he agreed with the emerging middle-class opinion that the world would be a better place if everyone really did conduct themselves this way, and avoid confusing and potentially corrupting ongoing entanglements. We should all just pay the money, say please and thank you, and leave the store. What's more, he uses this utopian image to make a larger point, that even if all businesses operated like the great commercial companies, with an eye only to self-interest, it wouldn't matter. Even the natural selfishness and rapacity of the rich, with all their vain and insatiable desires, will still, through the logic of the invisible hand, lead to the benefit of all. In other words, Smith simply imagined the role of consumer credit in his own day, just as he had his account of the origins of money. This allowed him to ignore the role of both benevolence and malevolence in economic affairs, both the ethos of mutual aid that forms the necessary foundation of anything that would look like a free market, that is, one which is not simply created and maintained by the state, and the violence and sheer vindictiveness that had actually gone into creating the competitive self-interested markets that he was using as his model. Nietzsche, in turn, was taking up Smith's premises that life is exchange, but laying bare everything, the torture, the murder, and the mutilation, that Smith preferred not to have to talk about. Now that we've seen just a little of the social context, it's difficult to read Nietzsche's otherwise puzzling descriptions of ancient hunters and herdsmen keeping accounts of debts and demanding each other's eyes and fingers without immediately thinking of Casimir's executioner, who actually did present his master with a bill for gouged eyes and severed fingers. What he's really describing is what it took to produce a world in which the son of a prosperous middle-class reverend, such as himself, could simply assume that all human life is premised on calculated, self-interested exchange. Part 3. Impersonal credit money. One reason that historians took so long to notice the elaborate popular credit systems of Tudor and Stuart England is that the intellectuals of the time spoke about money in the abstract. They rarely mentioned it. For the educated classes, money soon came to mean gold and silver. Most wrote as if it could be taken for granted that gold and silver had always been used as money for all nations in history, and presumably always would be. Now this not only flew in the face of Aristotle, it directly contradicted the discoveries of European explorers of the time, who were finding shell money, bead money, feather money, salt money, and an endless variety of other currencies everywhere they went. Yet all this just caused economic thinkers to dig in their heels. Some appealed to alchemy, to argue that the monetary status of gold and silver had a natural basis. Gold, which partook of the sun, and silver, which partook of the moon, were the perfected, eternal forms of metal toward which all baser metals tend to evolve. Most, however, didn't feel that much of an explanation was required. The intrinsic value of precious metals was simply self-evident. As a result, when royal advisers of London pamphleteers discussed economic problems, the issues they debated were always the same. How do we keep bullion from leaving the country? What do we do about the crippling shortage of coin? For most, questions like how do we maintain trust in local credit systems simply did not arise. This was even more extreme in Britain than on the continent, where crying up or crying down the currency was still an option. In Britain, after a disastrous attempt at devaluation under the Tudors, such expedients were abandoned. Henceforth, debasement became a moral issue. For the government to mix base metal into the pure eternal substance of a coin was clearly wrong. So, to a lesser extent, was coin clipping, a near universal practice in England, which might be thought of as a kind of popular version of devaluation, since it involved secretly shaving silver off the edges of coins, and then pressing them down so they seemed like they were still the original size. What's more, those new forms of virtual money that began to emerge in the New Age were firmly rooted in these same assumptions. Now this is critical because it helps explain what might otherwise seem a bizarre contradiction. How is it that this age of ruthless materialism in which the notion that money was a social convention was definitively rejected, also saw the rise of paper money, along with a whole host of new credit instruments and forms of financial abstraction that have become so typical of modern capitalism. True, most of these checks, bonds, stocks, annuities had their origins in the metaphysical world of the Middle Ages, yet, in this new age, they underwent an enormous efflorescence. If one looks at the actual history, though, it quickly becomes clear that all of these new forms of money in no way undermine the assumption that money was founded on the intrinsic value of gold and silver. In fact, they reinforced it. What seems to have happened is that once credit became unlatched from real relations of trust between individuals, whether merchants or villagers, it simply became apparent that money could, in effect, be produced simply by saying it was there, but that when this is done in the amoral world of a competitive marketplace, it would almost inevitably lead to scams and confidence games of every sort, causing the guardians of the system to periodically panic and seek new ways to latch the value of the various forms of paper back onto gold and silver. This is the story normally told as the origins of modern banking. From our perspective, though, what this reveals is just how closely bound together war, bullion, and these new credit instruments were. One need only consider the paths not travelled. For instance, there was no intrinsic reason why a bill of exchange couldn't be endorsed over to a third party, then becoming generally transferable, thus, in effect, turning it into a form of paper money. Now, this is how paper money first emerged in China. In medieval Europe, there were periodic movements in that direction, but for a variety of reasons, they didn't go far. Alternately, bankers can produce money by issuing book credits for more than they have on cash reserve. And this is considered the very essence of modern banking, and it can lead to the circulation of private banknotes. Some moves were made in this direction as well, especially in Italy, but it was a risky proposition since there was always the danger of depositors panicking and making a run, and most medieval governments threatened extremely harsh penalties on bankers unable to make restitution in such cases, as witnessed by the example of Francesco Castello, beheaded in front of his own bank in Barcelona in 1360. Where bankers effectively controlled medieval governments, it proved safer and more profitable to manipulate the government's own finances. The history of modern financial instruments and the ultimate origins of paper money really begin with the issuing of municipal bonds, a practice begun by the Venetian government in the 12th century when, needing a quick infusion of income for military purposes, it levied a compulsory loan on its tax-paying citizens, for which it promised each of them 5% annual interest, and allowed the bonds or contracts to become negotiable, thus creating a market in government debt. They tended to be quite meticulous about interest payments, but since the bonds had no specific date of maturity, their market prices often fluctuated wildly with the city's political and military fortunes, and so did the resulting assessments of the likelihood that they would be able to be repaid. Similar practices quickly spread to other Italian states and to northern European merchant enclaves as well. The United Provinces of Holland financed their long war of independence against the Habsburgs, 1568-1648, largely through a series of forced loans, though they floated numerous voluntary bond issues as well. Forcing taxpayers to make a loan is, in one sense, simply demanding that they pay their taxes early. But when the Venetian state first agreed to pay interest, and in legal terms, this was again interesse, a penalty for late payment, it was in principle penalizing itself for not immediately giving the money back. It's easy to see how this might raise all sorts of questions about the legal and moral relation between people and government. Ultimately, the commercial classes in these mercantile republics that pioneered these new forms of financing did end up seeing themselves as owning the government more than they saw themselves as being in its debt. Not only the commercial classes. By 1650, a majority of Dutch households held at least a little government debt. However, the true paradox only appears when one begins to monetize this debt, that is, to take government promises to pay and allow them to circulate as currency. While already, by the 16th century, merchants were using bills of exchange to settle debts, government debt bonds, rentes, juros, annuities, were the real credit money of the New Age. It's here that we have to look for the real origins of the price revolution that hammered once independent townsfolk and villagers into the ground and opened the way for most of them to be ultimately reduced to wage labourers, working for those who had access to these higher forms of credit. Even in Seville, where the old treasure fleets from the New World first touched port in the old, bullion was not much used in day-to-day transactions. Most of it was taken directly to the warehouses of Genoese bankers operating from the port and stored for shipment east. But in the process, it became the basis for complex credit schemes whereby the value of the bullion was loaned to the emperor to fund military operations in exchange for papers entitling the bearer to interest-bearing annuities from the government, papers that could in turn be traded as if they were money. By such means, bankers could almost endlessly multiply the actual value of gold and silver they held. Already in the 1570s, we hear of fairs in places like Medina del Campo, not far from Seville, that had become veritable factories of certificates, with transactions carried out exclusively through paper. Since whether the Spanish government would actually pay their debts, or how regularly, were always slightly uncertain, the bills would tend to circulate at a discount, especially as the juros began circulating throughout the rest of Europe, causing continual inflation. It was only with the creation of the Bank of England in 1694 that one can speak of genuine paper money, since its banknotes were in no sense bonds. They were rooted, like all the others, in the king's war debts. Now, this can't be emphasized enough. The fact that money was no longer a debt owed to the king, but a debt owed by the king, made it very different than what it had been before. In many ways, it had become a mirror image of the older forms of money. The reader will recall that the Bank of England was created when a consortium of 40 London and Edinburgh merchants, mostly already creditors to the Crown, offered King William III a £1.2 million loan to help finance his war against France. In doing so, they also convinced him to allow them in return to form a corporation with a monopoly on the issuance of banknotes, which were in effect promissory notes for the money the king now owed them. This was the first independent national central bank, and it became the clearinghouse for debts owed between smaller banks. The notes soon developed into the first European national paper currency. Yet the great public debate of the time, a debate about the very nature of money, was about not paper but metal. And that salutary point is where we're going to leave David Graeber for this week. Due to time, we shall catch up on the rest of that sideshow discussion next week. Are we going to be happy to take one of the offers prepared for us by the plutocrats? We're going to choose from solutions offered on their commercially controlled media. Or are we going to reclaim our autonomy from the logic of money and say, rich or poor, everybody deserves fair treatment, and no quoting of mathematics or statistics is any sort of justification for what is in essence selfishness? I hope you found this show inspiring. You can download it from our website, as you can all previous episodes, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for your contributions. Keep giving all you can, especially outside of the world of money.